Radio News at 9:06.
From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Laura Kanoy, and this is The Exchange. It's been well over a year since anti-government protests in Syria turned into a full-scale civil war. As rebels battle it out with the Assad regime, civilians are trapped in the middle, and tens of thousands have fled, becoming refugees in neighboring countries like Turkey, Jordan, and Lebanon. And in addition to coping with the flow of refugees, these countries fear increased terrorist activity across these boundaries. And Turkey, for one, would like more U.S. engagement in the Syrian conflict. That was the message over the weekend for Secretary of State Hillary Clinton when she went to Turkey. Clinton didn't make any specific promises of military aid, but she did announce $5 million more in humanitarian assistance to Syrian refugees. The U.S. has already provided $25 million to the Syrian opposition. Today in The Exchange, the situation in Syria, what's happening there and why, also how the U.S. sees its role in this conflict. Let's hear from you. If you have business or personal ties to Syria, what do you make of the violence there? What have you heard from Syrians you know? Also, what should the U.S. role in this conflict be, if any? Give us a call, The Exchange number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. You can send us an email, exchange@nhpr.org is the address, or post a comment on our Facebook page. We have three guests with us in studio. Is Sarwar Kashmiri, Senior Fellow in the International Security Program of the Atlantic Council. He's also a foreign affairs commentator. His latest book is called NATO 2.0. And Sarwar, welcome back. Nice to see you.
Good to see you.
Also with us, Lou Salome, a Syrian-American and longtime war correspondent, now living in Portsmouth. Lou has reported throughout the Middle East, including Syria, and still has family ties in that country. His latest book is called Violence, Veils, and Bloodlines. And Lou Salome, a welcome back to you, too. Thanks for your time today.
Thank you very much, Laura. It's good to be here.
Also with us, Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science and director of the Center for Civic Engagement at New England College. And Wayne, always good to have you. Thank you.
My pleasure, Laura. Thanks.
Well, Wayne, I'll start with you. Put this in the context of the broader Arab Spring that started in Tunisia of late 2010. We don't need to go all the way back, but just remind us where Syria fits in this larger Arab Spring picture.
Right. Well, we have seen in a variety of different countries a movement, a homegrown, local-grown movement of citizens sort of rising up and saying, enough is enough. We want to see some reform, some change. And depending on the country, those took more violent tones versus more civic tones. But most famously, I think what we saw was in Egypt, right, with Egypt's sort of radical transformation, Mubarak going away and being replaced through democratic elections, a very interesting process. So Syria seems to be the next in a series of countries that are going through these kinds of changes. The Assad regime has responded with violence, which we saw some of in Egypt, but not to the level we're seeing in Syria. And we're seeing a real struggle. Some have come out and called it a civil war in Syria. Maybe not quite there yet, but certainly it appears to be going in that direction between a regime that's trying to hold on to power and people that are trying to find their way to reform.
Well, and in all these Arab Spring countries, Wayne, you know, there was hard work, loss of life, incredible bravery on the part of the people. But boy, Syria seems worst of all.
It seems that there's very little progress, that's for sure, and the violence, level of violence seems to be at very high. And the regime has been very resistant to any sort of change or accommodation, and we're seeing outside elements bringing in weapons to the rebels and this escalating in a very violent way. I don't think we've seen the worst of it by far. I think it's going to get much worse before it gets better.
Well, and Sarwar Kashmiri, to you, you know, earlier on in the Arab Spring, as people looked at which countries would fall and which might not, it seemed to some people that Syria was one of those countries that would not fall. The Assad family seemed so strong, had been in power for so long. What happened to change that equation, Sarwar?
Well, I think the situation in Syria is far more complicated than has made out to be in the headlines. I'd just like to place my answer by putting it into a much, much wider perspective. The fact is that the United States has really very little latitude and very little that it can do. And let me explain what I mean. In Libya, the United Nations Security Council passed a resolution to save lives. As the Russians and Chinese observed, the United States and NATO allies changed that to mean regime change. And they understood that, and they're opposing the any further resolutions from the United Nations. I might point out, in Afghanistan, we have 100,000 troops that we're trying to get out, and the latest plan is most of them will exit through Central Asia. And therefore, Russia becomes a big point in the success of that plan, which means that we really cannot take on Russia and Syria without thinking about that. China, the other opponent of our plan to go to the UN, is taking on a very big role in the South China Sea that the United States is trying to now come to grips with. So there are forces with Russia, China, geopolitical, that are connected here, which means that America has very little flexibility. Finally, the Iraqi invasion and its aftermath has left the United States with very little credibility to lead.
And I want to talk about the U.S. role in a little bit, Sarwar, and this United Nations Security Council votes that you referenced, China and Russia, causing trouble for the U.S. and the Security Council. But telescope down to Syria for a moment, if you could. And I appreciate that this is a regional, indeed international issue. But why do you think Syria did tap into this Arab Spring momentum, even given how tough the Assad regime was and how long it had been in power?
Well, let's not, I think, make that big leap that Syria tied into the Arab Spring moment. There were people in Syria who wished to topple Assad. I'm not certain that the majority of the people in the Alawites who rule the country, Assad's family, really thought about the Arab Spring. I'm not certain that a lot of people in Syria talked about the Arab Spring. I think there was a group that wanted to topple Assad, and they were egged on by outside forces. Syria was then egged on by Russia and China. So now we have a situation that regional powers, world powers, are fighting in a proxy war. So I'm not certain that this can be related to Tunisia or Egypt or any of the other countries.
Interesting. So this is the first time I've heard the term proxy war used in this conflict. And Wayne's nodding, so we'll get to that. But I want to bring you in, Lou Salome, as well. It's often said that Syria is breaking down into a sectarian civil war. And that's your specialty, Lou, the long ties of blood, clan, tribe, religion that tie people together and pull them apart. Just remind us about some of the long-standing rivalries in Syria. It isn't like everybody was happy and singing kumbaya before this happened.
Well, the Alawite sect to which the Assad family belongs and which controls the military, intelligence, and security services runs the country and has oppressed the Sunni majority, the vast number of the Sunnis, for 42 years or so. And so this kind of a conflict was inevitable. At some point, this had to happen. But the actual conflict started in a harmless way in Daraa, in southern Syria. And it could have been handled in a much more delicate, sensitive way, and it probably would have been over quickly. But that's not the way things work in Syria and in many countries in the Middle East. It's you grab for the throat and you squeeze. So Assad has supported and defended all the minorities in Syria, including the Christian minority, as well as the Alawites. And you have Druze, and you have Circassians, and you have a number of, you have Turkmen, and so on. And he has defended them. And in return, they've supported him. So now they feel very much in danger because of what might happen post-Assad. And that's where you really are. And I agree with the point about this has become, it didn't start as a surrogate war, but it has become a surrogate war. Turkey, Qatar, Saudi Arabia, they're acting on behalf of the Western powers, notably the United States. And that's the danger now. That's what's being introduced into the conflict. And I see no way, for Assad to survive this thing. And it's a very explosive thing in the region. It's an opportunity for the West, in the Western eyes, to weaken Iran and to weaken Hezbollah.
And concerns about terrorist groups taking hold there. Lots more to talk about, gentlemen, but let me invite our listeners to join us as well. Our number here in the Exchange is 1-800-892-6477. And today in the Exchange, we are looking at the situation in Syria. The news has been all bad, practically, from that country. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton focused on this issue in a visit to Turkey over the weekend. Our number for you to join us with your questions or comments on what is happening in Syria, what it might mean for the United States, is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org, or post a comment on our Facebook page. And gentlemen, before we go any further, Lou, I also did want to ask you, as I said at the outset, you're a Syrian American, you still have cousins in Syria. What are you hearing from them?
Well, I have first cousins in Syria, and there's a great deal of fear among the Christians who live in the town and the surrounding towns where my family came from, about 25 miles northeast of Damascus. They're very much afraid.
Because they, again, made ties with Assad.
Because of their connection to the regime.
Right.
And the fear that the post-regime would be run by the Muslim Brotherhood, the Sunni majority, and that scares them a great deal. Now, things have changed in relation to the ability of the people in the towns around Damascus to move freely, because there's been some violence in Damascus, and it's increased, but I don't think it's as bad as it's been presented. At least that's what I'm hearing.
And is that where they are in Damascus?
They're northeast of Damascus, mm-hmm. 25 miles northeast of Damascus. And the van service, the bus service to and from Damascus has changed. They don't run at night anymore because nighttime in a war zone is always very dangerous. Even if there's nothing really going on, but there's fear, you react to the fear. It's the perception that matters a great deal. So they go on different routes. They don't go through certain towns. They go through other towns where they know there'll be more safety, and they don't run at night.
What about food and water? Necessities.
Oh, well, you know, Syria is not a poor country. Syria is self-supporting. That's not to say all the people are well off, but the country can support itself. And there's no problem with that. And the fighting has been, as you know, it was in Homs, it was in Hama in central Syria, and it's moved up to Idlib in northwest. There's a long animosity between Turkey there in that region. You could go on and on and talk about
but we won't, because we're heading into a break. We'll be right back. We'll start taking your calls, too, after break. So stay with us.
Good morning. It's 9:19, and more on the situation in Syria on The Exchange on NHPR and at 10 on The Diane Rehm Show. Mitt Romney chooses a running mate. Well, you only have until this Saturday at noon to enter to win NHPR's summer car raffle, so don't miss out on your chance to win a kayak, a bike, or a brand new hybrid car, and help support NHPR at the same time. Go to nhpr.org to buy your raffle tickets or call 1-888-805-NHPR. New Hampshire weather today, partly to mostly sunny across the state. Chance of a shower or thunderstorm in the North Country. Highs today in the 80s. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Union Leader and NewHampshire.com, opening up the stories, events, and resources essential to living in the Granite State. And from Nathan Wexler and Company, CPAs and business advisors, serving entrepreneurial clients who share a passion for competency, integrity, and community enrichment. 224-5357. This is NHPR.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Today in The Exchange, the conflict in Syria, how it began, and what the U.S. role might be. 1-800-892-6477 is the number for you to join us. If you have family ties, friends, business ties in Syria, what are you hearing from that country? What do you make of the violence there? Also, more broadly, what do you think the U.S. role in this conflict should be, if any role at all? Our number, 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post a comment on our Facebook page. And Wayne Lesperance, Lou Salome, Sawar Kashmiri, let's go to our callers now. And Don is joining us from Andover. Hi, Don. Thanks for calling in. Go ahead.
Thank you, Laura. I'm upset by the people taking pot shots at the president for what they think as his not interfering or taking an active enough role in this conflict. People such as Nicholas Kristof, John McCain, former secretaries of state, are asking him to take a more active role. But it's such a delicate situation. I respect his stance. I respect the way he handled Libya. I respect the way he's handled Israel and the Palestinians. And I think they should respect the way he is handling Syria up to this point. Thank you.
Okay, Don, thanks a lot for calling in. And Wayne, boy, this gets us right into the U.S. role. Hillary Clinton, as we said, talked about Syria over the weekend in neighboring Turkey and kind of pulled back, you know. She said when asked about military actions beyond financial aid for the rebels, she said that's a decision that requires, quote, intense analysis and operational planning. So really not making any promises there.
Right. And I think Sarwar had it exactly right early on when he said this is a very complicated issue. There's no easy answer. You know, you have a very complex country with competing factions or confessionals in the country. You know, you have no clear group that you support that you can count on is going to be representing your interests. There's certainly no stomach for American boots on the ground. McCain has talked about a no-fly zone, but it really isn't the Syrian Air Force that has been an issue. It is troops on the ground. And I think the president has done a fairly good job of trying to assemble a coalition, trying to press the Europeans to enact stronger sanctions against Syria, trying to get Turkey to play a more active role in relying on the Gulf allies. So the president has kind of put together, I think, the best kind of arrangement that he can. The nightmare scenario here is, obviously, we're in an election year, that this in some way blows up, right, between now and November. And the president is sort of caught flat-footed because it appears that he didn't have a better strategy. But in reality, and in fairness, there's not a whole lot more the United States can do that the American people would support.
Although Turkey reportedly said, according to CNN now, Sarwar, Turkey said, we feel very much alone, United States. We'd like a little more help. I mean, 50,000 refugees flowing over the border, concerns about terrorist activity along that border.
Yes, and I agree entirely with you, Laura, when you talked about Mrs. Clinton. I think the message she was sending was that the United States is going to stay on the path that it is now. It is not going to actively intervene. I mean, I think, as Wayne pointed out earlier, it's instructive. A year ago, the president of the United States said that Assad must go. I mean, I thought that was a huge mistake. You don't go out and say it unless you can do something about it. You know, sometimes I think Russia, Wayne, ought to say, hey, we remove all our objections. Go do what you want. And then what are we going to do? But the point is that's what we said. And so a year later, after thousands of deaths, Mrs. Clinton makes this statement about more planning, more coordination, which I think is reality. There's very little the United States can do. The more actively involved we get, the more muddled the situation will be. And I think Don is exactly right to be concerned about that, and the election year just magnifies the issue.
Our number again is 1-800-892-6477. Don, thank you for that call. The number 1-800-892-6477. We want your questions and comments about the situation in Syria, and especially what role the U.S. might take, if any. You can email us, exchange@nhpr.org, post a comment on our Facebook page, or call 1-800-892-6477. So, okay, Lou Salome, when we look at the U.S., and Sarwar said he thinks that there's very little the U.S. can do, but some people must be saying, yeah, but what about Libya? We helped them out big time. NATO went in, and boom, boom, Gaddafi's gone. Why can't we do that in Syria?
Well, Laura, Libya and Syria are two very, very different situations. I mean, Libya is entirely, almost entirely, 99% Sunni, and Gaddafi has no friends in the region at all, in the world, practically none. Syria has, alliances with Iran, long-term with Russia going back to the Cold War, and with Hezbollah in Lebanon. So you got to tread very, very carefully there. I'd like to go back to the sectarian and tribal question that you mentioned earlier. I left out the Kurds.
Yes, very important.
Who are more than 2 million, and that is a big, big problem for Turkey to start mucking around in more than they're already doing in Syria, invites a border problem with the Kurds. and with in Syria, in Iran, and also in Turkey, where the PKK, the Kurdish Workers Party, operates.
So just to clarify, Lou, 2 million mean there's 2 million Kurds
in
Syria.
Exactly, more than 2 million.
And Turkey has a large Kurdish population. And just for folks who aren't clear on this, the Kurds are sort of a people without a country, with pockets in Iraq, Turkey, Syria, and they'd love to have their own country.
They'd love to have Kurdistan. They'd love to have the country of Kurdistan, absolutely. And, you know, there's a long history between Syria and Kurds. The Syrians under Assad allowed the PKK to train in Syrian-controlled areas of Lebanon. I mean, I visited those bases, and I saw the training that went on there. And Öcalan, who's now still in prison, I believe, in Turkey, he was given refuge in,
and who is
in
that?
Damascus. He's the leader of the PKK. His last name is O-C-A-L-A-N, I believe, and he goes by the name of Öcalan. So he was given refuge in Damascus for many, many years. In fact, the Turkish army also went across the border into Syria during the mid-90s to wave the battle flag to Syria and say, stop helping these PKK people. I was there at that time. I saw that happening. And the United States allowed the Turks to bomb and to go over the border into Iraq after the first Gulf War.
Wow. So no love lost between Turkey and Syria.
And, you know, that province of Hatay in Turkey, down in the southwest corner, that used to be part of Syria until 1939, when the French, decided, well, they don't want Turkey going on into World War II on the side of the Germans. So we'll give them. They were in control of that area of Lebanon and Turkey at the Syria at the time. They said, oh, we'll give them Hatay, pacify them. And so that's a sore spot, and that's where a lot of the border crossing and the fighting is taking place now in Syria and Turkey.
So no love lost again between these two countries, Turkey and Syria. And yet Turkey, big ally of the United States, Sarwar, and is hosting 50,000 Syrian refugees.
Indeed.
And so, that's a funny situation for them to be
in. It is a funny situation, but a quick comment on what Lou said. I was talking to a senior intelligence official in Washington last month, and he told me, you know why we did Libya? Because we could do it.
Yeah. Because Libya had no friends in the region.
Because we could do it. And here I'm not certain that we can do it. But in answer to Turkey, you know, we should keep in mind that Turkey, 2 years from now, will have $100 billion trade with Russia, right? It's huge. So Russia, Turkey, Syria, Iran, these are all entities that are tied in with trade, commercial relationships. Turkey's biggest interest, I believe, is to make sure that the refugees that are coming in are taken care of. They need some help with that. And the PKK is not allowed to establish a base there. Beyond that, I think they would like to continue to be a close ally of the United States, which I believe they are. But that's as far as it goes. So I'm in the camp of those people who say, don't lead, follow.
Don't lead, follow, meaning United States.
Exactly.
This is not Libya.
This is not Libya, and our national interest is to keep Syria together as much as we can, and we have no cards that we can play, very few assets.
Again, our number for you to join us on these questions that we're pondering this hour about the situation in Syria is 1-800-892-6477, 1-800-892-NHPR. Send us an email if you'd like, exchange@nhpr.org is the address, or post a comment on our Facebook page. Again, your questions and comments are welcome at 1-800-892-6477. You know, I'm just getting a sense from the three of you how complicated this is. And Wayne, I can't believe I'm bringing another country into this equation, but Iraq, very busy dealing with its own internal violence. How does Syria's upheavals affect Iraq?
Well, there is a shared border there, and we have, over the history of the conflict in Iraq, seen foreign fighters entering Iraq through Syria. And there are at least some analysts who have said there have been more Americans killed by those foreign fighters, particularly early on in the war, coming through Syria than what we talk about when we talk about those coming from Iran directly. Iran plays a major role in supporting Syria and has an ability to provide fighters, provide material, weapons, support through Syria. So that's a very frightening component to this conversation, although often overlooked. That may be a place where the United States can play a larger role if it wanted to use military resources, that is, to protect that border with Iraq. and perhaps to create, if we get to a point where this makes sense, safe havens for refugees or for groups that we want to support within Syria. But let's go back for a second to this idea of Assad must go. This probably was the big mistake the president made, if we're going to be critical of him, because they're, you know, at risk of being very unpopular on your show, Laura, you know, when grownups look at this region and the Arab Spring and say, hey, democracy is a wonderful thing, which we often say, we have to step back and say, well, what are the consequences of democracy? When people elect leadership that is hostile to American interests, that is hostile to the values that we want, that aren't really committed to democracy in the long term, they're committed to democracy to get themselves elected and in power, then we have to sort of say, well, what is in our long-term interest? And there may have been an opportunity to apply leverage to Assad to say, you know what, we're not going to advocate for your removal, but you're going to play ball with us on a couple of key issues, peace with Israel, dealing with the Golan Heights situation, and a variety of other things, getting Iran out of your country. There are places where we could have applied leverage. That, to me, was a missed opportunity, and the ship has certainly sailed. So I think, yes, Iraq is a major piece. We have a very strong interest in Iraq. We could do some more on that border. But I think that there has been some missed opportunities, frankly, because I think folks just did not want to play that real politic game, and they very much wedded to this language of democracy and the Arab Spring and all of that.
So we need to take our rose-colored glasses off, Wayne, when we talk about the Arab Spring.
Never have had them on. We really shouldn't. This is a tough neighborhood. This is a part of the world where the Jeffersonian democracy that George Bush talked about, that Bill Clinton talked about, isn't reality. The separation of mosque and state isn't a tradition, right, that it is in the United States. And so having these kinds of policies that are based on facts that aren't real, that's a great goal, but it's not very realistic, I would argue.
Well, Lou, love to hear from you on that, too. Again, your book was Violence, Veils, and Bloodlines. You spent much of your career reporting through the Middle East on these conflicts that are often not completely understood by Americans and even their policymakers. What do you think about what Wayne says?
Well, I agree with what Wayne says, and I would add that the Iran issue, and when you bring Iran into the equation, it's an ally of Syria and Hezbollah in Lebanon also. You also bring Israel into the equation. So Iran sits there, you know, they'd like to do more, perhaps to help their allies in Syria. But are they going to play the game of chicken? Are they going to wait and see? Are they going to do something that might provoke Israel? And is Israel going to take the bait with the American approval and counter something that the Iranians might do and say they're hitting their nuclear facility? It's a very explosive, very dangerous game that you get into. And I think that what we're seeing from the United States is part of what George Bush the Elder called the New World Order. Nobody talks about this anymore. What is the New World Order? And I think it is that the United States is going to have a hand in determining the outcome of events in a lot of different places in the world. Now, we saw it in Iraq. We saw it in Afghanistan, which many people consider justified because of the attack here, but could have been handled in a different way. We saw it in, before Bush said New World Order. We saw it in Lebanon with Reagan, which was a terrible mistake, getting involved there. So I think that we're seeing the intelligence agencies and the Pentagon really directing American policy here more than presidents. A new president gets in. All right, he's got Cheney and he's got Rumsfeld. That's Bush the Younger. And they're in tune with everything that the New World Order says we ought to be doing. And they push it forward ahead. You get somebody else who's not so inclined, but they really can't do very much because the pattern, the rules have been set.
The wheels are already in motion. Yeah. Let me ask you a question, Sarwar, and this is following up on what Wayne said. You know, you need to not just say, hurrah, democracy, Arab Spring, hooray. But the other side of that is, you know, the people. And for a long time, the people of Egypt, it seems to me, were mad at us because we talked democracy out of one side of our mouth, but on the other hand, we were best friends with, you know, Hosni Mubarak. Could you say the same about what's happening in Syria? You know, I understand Wayne's criticism. Maybe Assad must go a year ago was premature, but, you know, again, if the United States is going to stand as a beacon of democracy and hope for ordinary people, Shouldn't we support the overthrow of dictatorial regimes?
I think that's an excellent question. Let's not forget that a few years ago, the United States was renditioning people to Syria. So when the CIA wanted to get answers from people, we couldn't torture them here. We sent them over to Mr. Assad to be tortured and to get the answers. So this happened 4 years ago. The most prominent example of this was a Canadian who was picked up at JFK and sent off to Syria when we didn't have enough proof. We said to the Syrians, you try get proof for it. So I agree entirely about this issue of being fair. But there's a much larger geopolitical issue, and if I may slightly respectfully disagree, Lou, is that the ability of the United States to influence matters around the world is rapidly diminishing. There was a time when a large industrial country broke enough crockery could get what it wanted done. But as the last 10 years have shown, after fighting continuously, we've not been able to exert our will either in Iraq or in Afghanistan. So how do we come to grips with this? And I believe we come to grips with it by saying that we cannot be leaders all around the world. We need to pick and choose. We need to have American values. But the world is different. People are different. And might does not make it anymore.
So we don't have good creds anymore.
Well, we don't have good creds, but we still are the most powerful country in the world. So we can go in and demolish entire countries. But we need to now roll with the punches. And the punches are the people are moving. They want dignity. And that's what we need to figure out how to work with.
Well, and Lou, I know you want to jump in. But Wayne, I want to hear from you. Again, that's the sort of counter follow-up to what you said. What about the people and their desire for democracy? Don't we look like hypocrites if we say, yeah, yeah, democracy, but Assad, go ahead, you can stay?
Well, yes, we do. And that's been a longstanding criticism of the United States. The problem is, I mean, if we look, for example, at Egypt, the uprising in Egypt was really about, it was about economic conditions. It was about a segment of the population that was growing dramatically, right? College-educated young people who could not find jobs, had no hope for jobs. There were so many great stories written about that group of people and that demographic having very real-world problems, right, who finally said, enough. You know, we're tired of this game because we can't live, we can't work. And they rose up, and so many other issues were attached to that. So Mubarak's regime looked very hollow and very tin-eared to their concerns. I think that the question becomes, is having a wholesale change of government going to change anything? How many new jobs have been created in Egypt as a result of the Arab Spring? I would say not one. In fact, I would guess that many have been lost, right? How much has changed in Libya? How much is going to change in Syria with Assad gone? I believe we will have a civil war. 10 to 15% of the population are Alawites. They are very much wedded to this government. They're not going to give it up easily. They have the money. They have the arms. There's going to be a lot more bloodshed. And how is our cause in the Middle East, how are our interests in the Middle East advanced as a result of this?
All right. More questions for after a very short break. And we'll take your comments and questions as well at 1-800-892-6477.
This is NHPR 939. Good morning. Support for NHPR comes from UR members and from the New Hampshire Business Review, accepting nominations for the 2012 Business Excellence Awards, recognizing the achievements of small businesses. Details at nhbr.com. And Dartmouth Hitchcock, providing online health tools and podcasts for a healthier New Hampshire. Information at dartmouthhitchcock.org. This is NHPR.
The eponymous prize in NHPR's summer car raffle is, in fact, a choice of cars. If you're our grand prize winner, you could choose from a Toyota Prius or a Ford Fusion Hybrid, donated in part by Grapponi Automotive Group. Averaging 50 and 39 miles per gallon, respectively, either could save you a bunch on gas over the life of the car. Getting in on the raffle is as easy as buying a $50 ticket or two at nhpr.org. And good luck.
This is The Exchange. I'm Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on The Exchange, our coverage of the New Hampshire gubernatorial primary continues with Manchester Republican candidate Ovid Lamontagne. Email us your questions for the candidate before the program if you'd like. Exchange@nhpr.org is the address. And then join us for that interview tomorrow morning, live at 9. Today in The Exchange, the situation in Syria and the future U.S. role in this conflict, if any. Join our conversation with your thoughts, comments, 1-800-892-6477. If you have some knowledge of Syria, if you have business or family ties there, tell us what you make of the violence. Also, in general, how do you see the U.S. role in this area, in this conflict, if any at all? 1-800-892-6477 is our number. 1-800-892-NHPR. Email is exchange@nhpr.org. You can also post your comments on our Facebook page. And Lou Salome, Sarwar Kashmiri, Wayne Lesbruns, a couple more questions for you. I wanted to ask you, Lou, about the broader United Nations role in this. There's been a lot made of the fact that the UN said in the Libyan conflict, yeah, go ahead, NATO, you can go in. Russia and China, though, have said in this Syrian conflict, no, we do not accept UN action on this. What's behind that, Lou? Can you explain that to us?
Well, I think the Russians and Syrians have a longstanding relationship with Syria that goes back throughout the Cold War. And a lot of Syrians have studied in Russia. Doctors have gone there and people have gone and become doctors, engineers, and so on. And Russia wants back in the game, and Russia has ties with Iran, and they want to get back into the Middle Eastern game. China is expanding its investments and role in Africa, and I suppose that in the Middle East it's trying to do the same thing. But China is less of a concern, I think, than Russia.
Can you explain the Russian connection a little bit more? And you did a good job with it. But we often hear about this close relationship with Russia and Syria. And on the face of it, you think, why is that? They don't seem to have much in common.
Well, they don't, except for the fact that during the Cold War, the Arab countries were on the outside of the Western sphere, which was allied with Israel. And so if you're Syria or if you're one of the Arab or other Middle Eastern countries that wasn't Israel, you say, well, we need to have allies, too. We need to get money. We need to get the arms. So where do you go? You go to Czechoslovakia. You go to Russia, and you get from what you need from the Eastern Bloc. There's less now. It's changed now because the religion is out of the influence when it comes to Soviet Union. But before, I mean, it was an atheist society, and there was nothing there in common. But if you're Syria, you take what you can get from wherever you can get it. And that's what they did. And that's the reason for the ties. I mean, I've met Syrians in Soviet Union, and all they were doing was getting an education. Well, we can't come so easily to the United States. We're blocked there, so we'll go to Soviet Union.
The Russians also maintain a naval base in Syria, and that's important to them.
Yeah, that's true.
Because I think Lou's exactly right. Putin has decided that Russia is going to play a larger role in global affairs. I mean, we've even heard of Russia wanting a naval base in Cuba again. But in Syria, they've already have one, and they want to expand it. So that client-state relationship is a very long one. There's also economic. I think you made the point of the very large volume of trade between the two countries, and oil is a factor. So you have all of these pieces together, and Russia has definite economic interest in the country.
Mm-hmm. Cold War all over again, gentlemen.
Well, Putin has his way, maybe.
Wow. And Lou mentioned, Sarwar, Israel, and we touched on this earlier, but clearly a very, very strong ally of the United States in that region, looking nervously at what's happening in Syria.
Well, I think they are very nervous about what happens in Syria, and I think will continue to be that way because I'm not certain that they've quite figured out where they're headed. To me, the single biggest issue the United States needs to focus on in the Middle East with reverberations around the world is helping Palestinians and Israelis resolve their dispute. Study after study has mentioned that that is the most important issue that drives terrorism, provides a narrative for terrorists to deal with, shows the double face, in their opinion, of the United States. Without taking care of that, we simply cannot attack any other issue in the Middle East.
So that's really the idea. If you take care of that, Sarwar, you don't quite have to worry so much about infiltrations over the border and craziness in Syria?
Not that that's a button that you press and everything gets resolved,
right.
But it's a huge issue. And it provides a continuing narrative about the about the inability of the United States to be a neutral party and resolve the issue.
Speaking of neutral parties, Wayne, the United Nations, again, Lou talked about how Russia has stymied attempts in the UN to play a stronger role in Syria. What do you make of the United Nations' attempts to broker a deal? It ultimately failed a couple weeks ago. The high-profile envoy Kofi Annan resigned. Does this look bad for the UN? Does it look, once again, like a toothless tiger?
Maybe. I mean, it's what the UN was created to do, right? It's exactly the kind of role that the UN was created for. And I think Kofi Annan did yeoman's work trying to find a deal. I think anybody who knows the region or knows the Assad family could have told you it's not going to come to much, but it was something that the UN should have tried and did try. We'll see what happens going forward. The UN is a sum of its parts. If its members aren't willing to exert pressure, right, in the form of Russia or China in this case, the UN hasn't a role to play. So I think that's where we're at. The members have spoken. They're not going to endorse resolutions that are going to allow for broader action. And so the UN sort of moves to the sideline in this case. I think they will continue to pursue for talks and for peace. A new envoy has just been named, I think. But I don't expect much from the UN in this conflict.
I can see you want to jump in, Sarwar.
I just wanted to say that I thought Kofi Annan's mission for the UN was doomed before it started, sure, because he basically went in with the Western position that Assad must go. Lakhdar Brahimi, now with the UN, seems to be heading in that direction also. So if the UN takes that position, I don't see how the UN can do anything.
Let's take another call, gentlemen. Again, the number 1-800-892-6477. Email exchange at nhpr.org. And up next is Eric in Amherst. Hi, Eric. You're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Hi. How are you this morning?
Good. Go ahead.
Hi. I just wanted to comment. It seems to me that there's a tendency in the media, and not just in the media, but amongst Westerners in general, to view Middle Eastern countries all in the same light. We look at them and we see these dictatorships, not just in the Middle East, but throughout the world. And we think, you know, that they're all the same, that Gaddafi is the same as Hussein, is the same as Idi Amin, is the same as Bashar al-Assad, and they're not. And in Syria, at least, it's not so much an issue of Assad is the bad guy and he's the only problem. There's a robust infrastructure that exists in the country, and he just happens to be at the top. And so removing the head in this case isn't going to resolve anything because, as several of your guests today have mentioned, you know, there's sectarian differences. There's a minority that controls the vast majority of the infrastructure. And it's not just supported from within. It's also supported from without by countries like Russia that have a vested interest in the area. I've been sitting here waiting, and I've listened to a couple of comments, and the rose-tinted glasses thing is perfect with regards to looking at the country. We need to take them off. And also, you were just some of your guests were talking about the Soviet Union, or not the Soviet Union, but Russia now.
Yeah, I make that mistake sometimes myself.
Right. And, the only naval base that they have in the Mediterranean region is located in Syria.
Right, as Wayne pointed out. Yeah. Hey, let me ask you a question, Eric, because you're clearly watching this closely. And we'll follow up in just a minute on your comment about we view the Middle East all the same and it's not.
Yep, sure.
What do you think, given that you're watching this, the U.S. should do, if anything?
Well, I think that the United States needs to take a hands-off approach, to be honest. I think that this is a problem that needs to be resolved as much as possible from within. And I think that no matter how the United States deals with it, we're going to end up looking impotent, you know, in the region. We can't. There's no way for us to effectively intervene and not come out looking bad.
All right, Eric, thank you for the call. Great comments. And Lou, to you first. Boy, you can appreciate this given your reporting throughout the area. He said, we Americans view the Middle East as all the same, and they are not.
Well, I think that's true for the general public, but that's not true from what we've been saying right here. In fact, we've said quite the opposite in the past 45 minutes.
But what do you think?
Would ask Eric a question. I think Eric, I know he's not there, but I mean the question is he's well informed. So I wonder how much he's traveled and worked in the area.
Right. I guess my question for you is, given your reporting on the area and your understanding of the complexities, as you were trying to portray this to your American readers over the many decades you reported from the area, you know, how hard was it? How basic did you have to get explaining to people how things are set up over there? Did you have editors say, well, no one cares about that, Lou, that's too complicated?
Absolutely. The editors were the first barrier. You had to get through their ignorance, and you had to persuade them that this was an important story. I remember writing stories about how Syria during the first Gulf War actually helped the United States and the coalition against Iraq. And I ended up with like three paragraphs in a major newspaper in the United States.
Now, that's a big story.
Yeah,
that Syria
it was a big deal, you know, because you had to pull and tug the Syrians to come into the coalition. They had to be based in a certain area in Kuwait, so it didn't look too bad for them. And this was a big deal. And you can't get past the editors sometimes. It's a real problem. And it's worse now. That's 20 years ago. It's much worse now. If you just read the newspapers or even television, you get nothing but headlines. It's a big problem, and it perpetuates the ignorance of the American people.
Well, and Eric, it's a great point. And to his second point, the question I asked him, I'd like to ask all three of you, and maybe you first, Sawar Kashmiri. So Eric said he favors a hands-off approach in terms of what the U.S. should do regarding Syria. What about you?
I think that the United States should play a following role, not a leadership role. The countries there will determine their fate. The people in that region will determine their fate. Turkey is a growing power in that region. I believe it's a real mistake for the United States to continue to believe that we should be leading every situation in the world. We cannot be isolationists. The world is much more connected for that. So what I would do there is I would take my guidance from Turkey to begin with and move on from there. I think Mrs. Clinton did it exactly right. Let's plan. Let's coordinate. Unfortunately, as I think you mentioned, that we are in an election year, and there are some senators and congressmen who'd like us to go do this and that, set up a no-fly zone. You know, I might remind your listeners that to set up a no-fly zone, you first need to go and attack the anti-aircraft batteries. So does anyone here want to declare war on Syria? I don't think so. So we follow, not lead.
Although a hands-off approach, and I'm sorry to keep asking the same question, but is it fair to do that for the people of Syria who are clearly suffering? Refugees, at least 17,000 have died. And yet we went in and sort of rescued the people of Libya. We called it a humanitarian operation. It seems to me the Syrians are suffering just as much.
Well, it seems to me part of the reason the Syrians are suffering is because of our inability to get the UN to pass a resolution which would then give the Syrians some help. And I would submit the reason that that has happened is because the West took the UN resolution to protect people's lives, changed it into regime changed, and helped topple Gaddafi. I'm not shedding any tears that he was toppled. The Russians and Chinese have watched this. And in the future, they are not going to let the U.S. do that.
Well, what do you think, Wayne? And what would you like to see happen?
I think it's a bit more of an active role than what's been described, although I agree that it's not a U.S.-led role. I think there are opportunities to particularly provide humanitarian relief in Turkey to those refugees.
And Hillary Clinton announced more aid for that over the weekend.
So that's important to help support our allies in the region. And that's kind of the role I foresee, providing support. We can provide intelligence that others might be able to use. There is an opportunity to train if we can identify a group of people that are going to make up the resistance. I think the border with Iraq is important. I also think the biggest role we can play is in assuring Israel that if anything happens on that northeastern border, that the United States, you know, is committed to Israel's defense. So I think that there's a variety of pieces that the United States can play. Probably most important, though, is coordinating our allies, trying to isolate the regime, and to communicate to folks in Syria, if we're committed to changing the regime, that your future is not with Assad, your future is with the Europeans and with the Americans, and that they will be okay, they will be safe, the Christian minorities and the other minority groups. We will assure them, to the best that we can, that that people will be treated equally and fairly in Syria. Now, there's no history of that ever happening.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah, how do you assure
so
that?
Boy, I think that's the promise you make, but I don't know how you live up to that. But that's what they, I think, want to see. The only way I think Assad goes, by the way, is if you see that coalition he has crumble. If you see Alawites say, you know what, our future isn't going to look good with him remaining in power, or the Christian population, or the business community. If you can break apart his coalition somehow, then you've got a reasonable chance of getting him out. But short of that, this is going to be a very, very bloody conflict.
Well, and we haven't even talked about, Wayne, you said help with training if we can't identify a group that makes up the resistance. From what I've read, there's a couple different groups, so it's kind of hard to know who to support.
A couple of different groups, and here's the downside to the U.S. not being involved. We're seeing reports in the New York Times and other publications saying that in the absence of American and Western support, where are they turning?
Al-Qaeda.
So they're getting arms, they're getting training, they're getting support, but certainly not from groups that were interested.
That's a natural turn for them
because
of the Iraqis. The Sunnis in Iraq are the minority. We haven't mentioned the American presence in Syria. Namely, that we have intelligence officers on the ground supposedly determining who's going to get what arms. And that's been going on for some time, so we are there.
We don't know about it as much.
The American people don't know about it, but the Middle East operates on a surrogate platform. You use other people to do your dirty work for you. The Syrians have done it. The Iraqis have done it. In Lebanon, they do it. Iran does it. And that's what's being done now by the United States and the West, as I said earlier, through Turkey, Qatar, and the Saudis. They're doing a lot of the work, but we're also in there. We're also on the ground.
By the way, I do want to say that I'm a skeptic as far as the involvement of Al-Qaeda in Syria. I think that this is being used by the opposition, who's not getting enough arms, and it's getting defeated by the Syrians to coax the United States, and especially the United States, to say, hey, we'll get it from Al-Qaeda.
Using that as a threat.
If it is true, as the administration and the CIA claim, that we have demolished and destroyed Al-Qaeda, that's why we can leave Afghanistan, I just fail to understand how they can go into Syria 10,000 miles away.
Well, gentlemen, thank you so much, all of you, for being here. And Lou Salome, thank you so much for taking the time to be with
us
today.
You're most welcome, Laura. Thank you.
Lou Salome, a Syrian-American, longtime war correspondent in the area. His latest book is Violence, Veils, and Bloodlines. And by the way, best to your relatives, Lou, in Syria. And Wayne Lesperance, thank you for being here as well.
My pleasure. Thanks, Laura.
Wayne Lesperance, professor of political science, director of the Center for Civic Engagement at New England College. And Sarwar Kashmiri, thanks for making the trip. We appreciate it.
Your program is an asset to the community.
Sarwar Kashmiri, senior fellow in the International Security Program at the Atlantic Council. He's also a foreign affairs commentator. His latest book is called NATO 2.0. The Exchange is a production of NHPR. The engineer is Dan Colgan. Our producer is Ellen Grimm. Our volunteer is Priscilla Malcolm. Our intern's Tim Camerato. The Exchange executive producer is Keith Shields, and I'm Laura Kanoy.
The views expressed in this program are those of the individuals and not those of NHPR, its Board of Trustees, or its underwriters. If you missed any part of today's program, listen to The Exchange anytime at nhpr.org.
I'm Laura Kanoy, and tomorrow on The Exchange, our coverage of New Hampshire's gubernatorial primary continues with Republican Ovid Lamontagne. The Manchester lawyer is once again running for the state's highest office as a solid conservative on both social and fiscal matters. We'll get his stance on the issues and why he thinks he's the best choice for Republicans this fall. Email us your questions for Mr. Lamontagne at nhpr.org and join us for The Exchange tomorrow morning live at 9 and again at 8 p.m. here on NHPR.
Diane Rehm Show next at 10 o'clock.